Welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Casey Hopick, Executive Director of Umpqua Watersheds.
And I'm Angela Jensen, Conservation and Legal Director of Umpqua Watersheds.
In today's edition of Living Downstream, we're going to focus on the role of old forests in combating climate change. We are facing a climate emergency. We are, in fact, in a climate crisis. So for today's presentation, we're going to talk about mitigation. That is, how can we lessen the adverse effects and impacts of climate change? When we talk about mitigation, there are many topics that come up, from reducing emissions generally to increasing our planet's ability to sequester and store carbon. But today, we are going to focus on our forest here in the Pacific Northwest. And specifically, we want to focus on our region here in southwestern Oregon and the management of public forest lands with respect to climate change mitigation. First, can you give us a brief history of the ONC lands as they make up such a large part of federally managed public lands and tell us how they are currently being managed and why?
Sure, Casey, thank you. The history of our ONC lands is long and very interesting, and I think it's important to understand it so that we can see a clear picture as to why those lands in particular are being managed the way they are. So the history actually goes back to the 1800s to encourage settlement of Western lands. In the 1800s, our Congress established a land grant that would promote the completion of a railway system that would connect Marysville, California to Portland, Oregon. Specific lands were granted to the states of Oregon and California, respectively, giving each state the authority to designate a company to construct the railroad. This is how things were done back then. But it was the intention of Congress that granted land not used directly for the construction of the railroad be sold by the constructing company so that construction costs could be recovered. That was Congress's intention. Initially, no railroad company came forward with a proposal in the set time that was established by Congress. So in 1869, Congress amended the Granting Act to allow the Oregon and California Railroad Company the opportunity to meet a new deadline. And this amended legislation, however, carried three stipulations outlining the conditions of the disposal of the granted lands that were not going to be used for rail construction. The land was, first of all, supposed to be sold to bona fide settlers, and with no more than 160 acres sold to a single individual, and also that the land was to be sold for no more than $2.50 per acre. Very interesting piece of history there. Unfortunately, the ONC Railroad Company and the merged Southern Pacific Railroad Company both violated all three of these terms of the land grant. And these violations went undisputed, actually, until 1903, when the Southern Pacific Railroad decided to retain ownership of certain portions of the land that held valuable timber resources. And believing that the discontinuing of land sales would hinder the settlement and development of Western Oregon, the states actually turned to the federal government for assistance. And at that point, then actually this was on June 9th of 1916, this is when Congress passed the ONC Revestment Act. And this is otherwise known as the Chamberlain-Ferris Act. And this act returned the unsold granted lands back to federal ownership. And in returning the lands back to federal ownership, though this deprived the state of Oregon and the western counties, so the counties where we sit right now, 18 specifically, it deprived these counties of economic opportunity from private industry and a tax base for local governments. So understanding this plight, and after several failed pieces of legislation that attempted to rectify the issue, this is when Congress passed the ONC Act in 1937. The ONC Act, and I'll just read the statutory language here, it mandated that vested lands that were classified as forests or timberlands would, quote, shall be managed for permanent forest production, and the timber thereon shall be cut and removed in conformity with the principle of sustained yield for the purpose of providing a permanent source of timber supply, protecting watersheds, regulating stream flow, and contributing to the economic stability of local communities and industries, as well as for providing recreational facilities. It's important to note that the Act required that at least 500 million board feet, or no less than, quote, a sustainable yield capacity, be harvested and sold annually in order to fulfill the economic requirements of the counties. Once the past debts were paid back to the U.S. Treasury, the ONC counties that have advantage of this were entitled to, at least at that time, I am not 100% sure what it is now, I don't think it's changed, but they were entitled to 75% of the timber receipts. And it's because of this promise that our communities in Western Oregon were actually able to grow. But this is why the ONC lands were and still are primarily managed for permanent timber production.
So given that such a large portion of our public lands are currently managed primarily for timber production, how does this square with our climate change mitigation needs?
That's a really good question. First, it's important to understand the role of our forests in general. Through the process of photosynthesis, trees take in carbon dioxide from our atmosphere and store this carbon within itself as well as our soil. This is why our forests are often referred to as the lungs of the planet. And we often think of the forests in like South America, Brazil, and other tropical regions as being key sources of this carbon and oxygen exchange, as well as vital carbon sinks and reservoirs. And they most definitely are. But our forests here in the Pacific Northwest are just as important. Truth be told, our native forests here in the Pacific Northwest actually sequester more carbon per hectare than the tropics do. That's very, very interesting, and I think often misunderstood. I would like to pause here and explain first the difference between a carbon sink and a carbon reservoir. This can get confusing to people who don't quite understand. A carbon sink is a source that has the capacity to accumulate carbon or take into itself carbon from the atmosphere, take it out of the atmosphere and take it into itself. I like to think of it as a cleansing or filtering mechanism, and it's an ongoing process. So for example, each live tree goes through the process of photosynthesis and continues to do so for its own survival. The tree is a carbon sink, and the process by which it takes in carbon and stores that carbon is called sequestration. On the other hand, a carbon reservoir refers to carbon that's already accumulated or stored. So that tree is also a reservoir of carbon, right? Because it has already accumulated and stored that carbon. We need to fully understand that. And the older the tree, the greater the amount of carbon already accumulated and stored. This is why our old growth forests, our late successional reserves, our riparian reserves, this is why they're so important. We need these forest ecosystems left intact so that they can not only continue to act as carbon sinks and sequester carbon from our atmosphere, but also to continue to store the carbon already accumulated in the live trees, the dead trees, as well as the soil. This is just the natural process, and it's very important to understand this.
That's excellent information. I know we've all heard that the Amazon sequesters so much carbon, but in fact, the giant conifer forests of the Pacific Northwest, mostly Doug fir and sequoia, store more carbon per acre than any other forest in the world.
That's right. And even our lead scientists on the matter, I know Dr. Della Sala and Beverly Law, they have both stated unequivocally that our forests in the Pacific Northwest, here on our ONC lands, as well as the Tongass region in Alaska, these are global champs at mitigating climate change and sequestering the carbon. And yes, you make a really good point, and I'm glad you brought that up. Absolutely. And I know that, you know, there's a lot of confusion among the public, largely based on misinformation regarding forest management. We are often told that simply replanting our forests once they are logged fixes the problem, that younger trees are more efficient as carbon sinks. But this information, you know, it's used to support decisions to log on shorter rotations and such. The problem with this is that it ignores the forest as a reservoir, right? Once you remove the stored or accumulated carbon by extracting the mature tree, it cannot simply be replaced by planting the seedling. It doesn't work that way. Now, granted, you know, some carbon will continue to be stored in a finished wood product, but certainly not all of the accumulated carbon that that tree has had and has accumulated and stored, you know, up to that point and in the end of its life. And it's important to note that there are emissions associated with the extraction and the production of wood products. And what carbon is stored in the finished wood product only remains stored for the useful life of the product. So there's a misconception out here that, okay, if you log the tree and then you turn this into a finished wood product, I'm still holding on to all that carbon. That simply is not the case. Whereas, you know, a mature and or, you know, a dead or dying tree left in the forest ecosystem, this will slowly go through the process of decomposition and emit in doing so, emitting very little in comparison in the way of emissions. And much of the stored carbon actually remains in the forest reservoir, in fact, in the soil. So I just wanted to, I wanted to take some time to explain this because there's a lot of misinformation out there that supports the idea that a forest as a climate mitigation tool need not be, you know, our mature and old growth ecosystems, so long as we replant what we have extracted. But this philosophy is misguided because it does not account for our forests as reservoirs. Therefore, when we talk about trying to reduce the concentration of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, removing our reservoirs and replanting still creates a carbon footprint and contributes to this concentration. So we need to fully understand that. So this is why we need policies that will protect more than the 12% of our federal forests that are currently protected. We need to expand protections on our federal forest lands, protecting carbon-dense, mature, and old-growth forests, and make them off-limits to extractive interests. You know, this includes protecting mature forest ecosystems in our ONC lands. This is the role of our forest as a climate mitigation tool. It's an important one. And the best part about it is that it doesn't require funds for research and development. We have the forest, so let's protect them. We have plenty of plantations out there to support the wood products we need. So let's protect the mature and old growth for what it can give back to us in the way of climate mitigation.
Mitigating climate change is not the only role our forests play in combating climate change. Don't they also play a role in adaptation?
Yes, they most certainly do. Climate change is already upon us. We are already feeling its impacts. And so our forest ecosystems and the species that that they home. You know, we drier than average conditions are already giving way to more frequent and more intense wildfires. We are experiencing summer low flow events, decreased snowpacks. All of this impacts species and ecosystems, mostly in a very negative way. So adaptation becomes necessary. In fact, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change stated years ago that whatever our mitigation strategies may be, and they are necessary, they must also include strategies for adaptation, because there is no getting around the fact that changes are here and that more is coming. And this is because our atmosphere, even if we were to stop emissions altogether right now, the concentration that is in our atmosphere could still remain there for up to 50 years. So we're going to be feeling the effects of what we have put in the atmosphere today for a very long time. So changes are going to continue to come for at least for the foreseeable future. So adaptation can take many forms, from changed behavior in species to even migration. But science has shown us overwhelmingly that the greater the resilience of a species, an ecosystem, or community, greater the chances of adaptation and survival. And by and large, resilience comes in the form of intact and fully functional ecosystems. But the moment we interrupt the natural processes of our forests by logging or treatment, we take away the ecosystem's natural capacity to be resilient and adapt to change. So this is what the picture looks like. Our older and mature forest ecosystems are more resilient to the negative effects of climate change, like wildfire events, drought, pests, and other stresses. And by being resilient itself, it continues to provide habitat and a resilient ecosystem and service for many species. This is why it's important that we protect large areas of unspoiled habitat. Again, an intact ecosystem is a resilient one. And not only does it provide a buffer for various species to the impacts of climate change, allowing them space and time to adapt, it also provides species with the chance to safely migrate if need be, particularly if we also provide and protect corridors that connect these ecosystems. And these corridors are going to be very vital, I fear, going forward, because there is most definitely going to be migration of species toward, you know, to higher elevations as well as poleward, so moving north. As I mentioned earlier, our old growth and mature forest ecosystems, they're already very resilient to wildfire. So there is little doubt that protecting these will also provide resilience for communities, our communities, against wildfire events, events that are becoming all too common. We've been seeing it year after year. Higher intensity fires, more frequent, that are, you know, threatening our homes, our communities. So we must also recognize that our forests are the source of many ecosystem services, from clean water to clean air to protection of our own habitat, but also the services to habitat for species that we are inevitably connected to, even indirectly. So these functioning forest ecosystems are going to be crucial to our own resilience to the coming change brought on by our changing climate.
So Angela, it sounds like we need a new strategy to managing ONC lands as well as other federally managed public forest land.
Yes, we do. And we do indeed. And it needs to include a different perspective economically. Most of our governing statutes, while written to include language directing our federal agencies to manage for multiple uses, they were largely drafted in such a way that affords the agency to manage for a single purpose, timber production. The ONC Act of 1937 was most definitely written with timber production being the dominant purpose. But these statutes are simply outdated. So for example, the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act, the Federal Lands Policy Management Act, and even, and of course, the ONC Act, yeah, they all speak to protection of watersheds and the protection of the forest as a source of recreation. But there is nothing in these statutes that directly speaks to the need to manage our forests so that they are a mitigation and adaptation tool. This is obviously particularly so with the ONC Act. The other two, as I spoke of, the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act and the Federal Lands Policy Management Act, they actually encompass a broader spectrum of management for multiple uses. But most definitely, as we said earlier, the ONC Act is timber production as its dominant use. But we can't forget that the ONC Act did speak to protecting watersheds. In fact, because the ONC Act also spoke to, you know, protection of watersheds and the protection of the forest as a source of recreation, this gave rise to environmental groups challenging management decisions on the ONC lands. with the advent of ecological sciences and the changing public perception that was taking place in the 1980s, environmental groups came to challenge timber interests based on those principles of multiple uses and protection of watershed and protection of forests for recreation. And eventually, even the BLM came to acknowledge that it was Congress's intent in writing that legislation that the lands be managed under, quote, contemporary principles of ecology and conservation. But this all kind of got turned on its head in 1987. There was a case in the Ninth Circuit, O'Neill versus the US, where the Ninth Circuit Court ruled that recreation was not intended by Congress to be an expected outcome of the ONC legislation. The O'Neill Court went on to conclude that even a balancing interest with timber production was neither required or even permitted because the ONC Act mandates that the primary use of these revested lands be for timber production. But remember, these statutes, including the ONC Act, they direct agencies to manage the forest in a sustainable manner, right? The ONC Act directs the agency to manage for sustainable harvest, yes. However, unless the ONC lands are managed with climate change in mind, there's nothing sustainable about its management. You can only ensure a sustained yield if the forest can continue to reproduce the desired resource. But a forest ecosystem that is weakened by mismanagement, that is short rotation harvest, aggressive commercial thinning, and so on, that is exacerbated by climate change, is not likely going to be resilient to withstand the coming changes brought on by climate change. The forest will be more susceptible to drought, pests, and wildfire events. So from this perspective, one could hypothetically argue that the statute does mandate consideration of climate change. And to bring the U.S. Forest Service into this part of our discussion, you know, the Forest Service was mandated to manage according to a utilitarian philosophy, meaning the greatest good for the greatest number in the long run. And yet, despite this philosophy, which many have argued encompasses a conservation and wide use perspective, much of our U.S. Forest Service land has also been managed for timber production. But coming back to a new strategy for managing federal lands, and in particular, because we're focusing a lot on ONC lands, but federal lands in general, I think it requires a change in economic perspective and calculation. And this is something that I really want to research further, but it seems clear to me that the cost of not utilizing our public forest lands as a mitigation and even adaptation tool will cost us far more in the future than what it would cost now to conserve and preserve those carbon sinks and reservoirs. Let's think of it this way. If we fail to mitigate properly, and again, our forests are already there and doing the job for us, so require no additional expense for research and development. But if we fail to mitigate and utilize and protect the forest for the purposes of mitigation and even adaptation, what are the costs of such inaction that we will bear in the future? And certainly not just us, but our children and our grandchildren. The cost is simply too high. This is why a proper cost should be placed upon timber extraction entities. Let the price of removing such a vital mitigation and adaptation tool reflect the costs placed on future generations for having to adapt to an unreasonable climate and for being asked to rebuild what we have been dismantling and what we continue to dismantle. I think that's the new economic perspective. This is the perspective that we need, one that actually reflects the present and the future costs of removing the lungs of our planet and the very life of our ecosystems and communities.
Yes. Young trees store carbon at a faster rate, but their total mass is small. Think of it this way, would you rather to make 10% on $100 or 5% on $1 million? It's the total mass of carbon that matters. Older trees store more carbon in total than young trees. In some species, 75% of the carbon is stored after the tree is 50 years old. Old trees are critical to our survival.
That's exactly right.
There's an interesting publication called Old and Ancient Trees Are Life History Lottery Winners and Vital Evolutionary Resources for Long-Term Adaptive Capacity. And I just want to quote a couple paragraphs out of this, which really brings home why old growth trees are so special. Human cultures around the world have revered ancient trees as being powerful spiritual beings, connecting earth and heaven as sources of wisdom, fertility, balance, and longevity. These myths and legends are often embodied by a particularly old and venerated individual tree of exceptional presence, distinguishable from the many other large trees in the forest. These ancient trees are seen as belonging to a separate and special class of being that transcends the normal plane of existence, binding the tree to a deep knowledge and awareness of history, change, and persistence. With increasing knowledge about the role old trees play in ecosystems, biologists are also beginning to attach special importance to individual ancient trees and populations. The ecological importance of old trees and forested ecosystems has been extensively documented, particularly as small natural features that provide a wide range of services. And yet, our understanding of tree age structure and forested ecosystems remains poor. Fundamentally, the lifespan of even an average tree greatly exceeds the duration of any current ecological project. So true demographic studies of trees have never been carried out, except on cross-sectional, not longitudinal basis. We highlight several exceptional population-level demographic properties that emerge from these studies and discuss their evolutionary implications, particularly given long-term environmental cycles. First, a small proportion of individuals win the life history lottery and obtain exceptional ages, far more than 10 times greater than the median age in the population. These ancient trees are observed in natural populations and are possible because of the lack of program senescence enabled by the woody plant growth form and the low mortality rates observed in old growth forests. We argue that despite the rarity of these individuals, they play a significant role maintaining diversity in the population and bridging across unusual and infrequent environmental conditions. Second, a larger proportion of individuals reach significant ages many times greater than the median age. These old individuals contribute substantially to the stabilization of population diversity to intermediate environmental change. So this article really piqued something in me because we don't know enough about these old trees and why they're important. They've been around for 300, 400 years and played a vital role to those ecosystems. It reminds me of a book called The Blue Zones, written by Dan Bittner, who was contracted by the National Geographic Society to travel around the world and find areas of the world which have unusual longevity and interview people in those cultures to understand what is it about their lifestyle above and beyond genetics that allows people to live well into their over 100 years old. And now they've replicated with the Blue Zones project, and we have one in Roseburg to try to get lifestyles that are similar to those regions of the world that he explored, where they have high longevity. A lot of it has to do with stress and obviously what you eat, but also your community and what you're trying to build. The same applies to these old growth trees. They're very special, and there's so much that we don't know about them. And the fact that we have less than 10% of these old growth trees left in the Pacific Northwest is why it's vitally important to protect them.
Yeah. I am so glad that you brought that up. In fact, I you're absolutely right. I think it's like 8% of our old growth that is remaining. But you just hit on such a crucial point. We don't know enough about these old growth ecosystems. And that's why I have advocated for years that you can't dismantle a mature old growth forest ecosystem and simply think that replanting it is going to bring it all back. It's kind of like Humpty Dumpty, you know, once it falls off the wall and it's dismantled, we don't have the knowledge. We can't. These forests are so incredibly old and so complex that we don't have the knowledge to put it back together, much less the ability. So the only way we can, you know, maintain the full effect of the positive service that it can provide us, services, there's many services, is to protect them. And that's where we are.
Excellent.
Very good point.
I definitely want to really dig into this, and maybe it's a topic for another show. Again, it's old and ancient trees are life history lottery winners and vital evolutionary resources for long-term adaptive capacity. And this is written by Charles H. Cannon, Gianluca Pioversin, and Sergey Mune Bosch. So take a look at that. We'll put this article in our notes for this episode. Definitely want to take a look at it, because I think they're hitting on something that really hasn't been talked a lot about. It's not only the fact that it's an old tree and there are a few of them left there. They're playing a vital role in those ecosystems and have played that for hundreds of years.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. I'm excited to read that.
Angela, President Biden signed a climate action executive order on January 27th, 2021. In this executive order, he pledges to conserve 30% of the nation's land and water resources by 2030. What does this look like in our public lands? And can this executive order and Biden's 30-30 goal be compatible with the ONC Lands Act?
That is a really tough question. First, I think I'd like to provide a little perspective about where the 30-30 goal comes from. So in 2010, the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity pledged to protect 17% of land and 10% of ocean waters by 2020. And even at that time, and even more so shortly thereafter, many scientists considered that target to be very inadequate. So in 2017, a group of scientists authored what's called an ecoregion-based approach to protecting half of the global realm. And in this piece, the scientists urged for a global deal for nature. This conservation biology-based proposal argues that saving significant chunks of habitat for imperiled species will not only protect biodiversity, but also reduce atmospheric carbon by preventing new development and protecting natural carbon sinks. So immediately, you know, this goes to both mitigation and adaptation. In 2019, the same group published a more detailed report for the Global Deal for Nature that included, you know, principles, milestones, and targets. And in this, they argued that the Global Deal for Nature should be an essential complement to the Paris Climate Deal, which came out in 2015. And the Global Deal for Nature specifically stated that the most logical path to avoid the approaching crisis, climate crisis, in fact, is maintaining and restoring at least 50% of the Earth's land area as intact natural ecosystems in combination with energy transition measures. So, and then the Global Deal for Nature, or the GDN, it set an interim milestone target of 30% of lands conserved by 2030. So this is where President Biden is getting that 30-30 goal. And it's important to know that we're not even there. We're not even close. They've got a lot of work to do. So, but reading these goals into our current statutes, this is where it's going to be tough. You know, as we've already discussed, our statutes governing our forest, federal forest lands in particular, are, you know, geared toward extraction purposes, and specifically the ONC Act, most definitely. And so, but like I kind of alluded to earlier, you know, if we could focus on sustainability and the fact that even multiple uses have to be considered, right? So multiple uses must include climate mitigation and adaptation. This would be a new interpretation of the statutes, and in my opinion, it is at odds with the current mandates of the ONC Act. But as I've said, I maintain it comes back to sustainability. We cannot realize a sustained yield of timber from a dying ecosystem because we failed to mitigate properly. And we certainly cannot sustain for multiple purposes and multiple uses, including watershed protection, unless we manage our forest ecosystems in such a way that allows for ecosystem and habitat adaptation. So I think it's a tough go. I think there's going to have to be some revisions to our statutes, and that's going to be tough, especially with the ONC Act, as it has such a clear single purpose mandate. So it's definitely going to be interesting to see how Biden's executive order intersects or attempts to square with these older and outdated statutes, in particular the ONC Act. But we've got a lot of work ahead of us, and President Biden is on the right track by pursuing the 30-30 goal. But there's definitely a lot of work ahead.
Excellent.
Let's take a break. We'll be right back after these announcements. Hi, this is Casey Hovick, Executive Director with Umpqua Watersheds.
And I am Ryan Kincaid, Umpqua Watersheds Director of Education and Outreach, as well as the Chair of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee.
Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute.
We are excited to utilize our radio station, KQUA, as a platform for marginalized voices. If you are interested in hosting a radio program honoring diverse perspectives and elevating those who have been oppressed, please email your idea to ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. That's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org.
Programming on KQUA 99.7 is funded in part by Umpqua Valley Audubon Society, connecting people with nature to inspire the protection of our natural world. More information at www.umpquaaudubon.org.
Programming on KQUA is supported in part by Medicine Flower, specializing in flavors, aromatherapy supplies, natural remedies, and rocks and minerals from around the world. More information at genuineessentialoils.com.
So, Angela, we're working hard to implement Biden's 30-30 plan. And one of the groups that we're involved in is the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance. And we're in the process of sending a letter to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Department of Interior, Eric Werwa, and Eve Barnett, who's a Policy and Intergovernment Affairs Analyst. And we have several groups across the country, and we'll talk more about that. But I think it's important that we share this letter with our listeners so they can understand that a lot of groups are working together to help make this happen. And the things in the letter are important to know. So let's read the letter, take turns. We'll take turns so people don't have to just listen to one of us, but it is really important information.
This is a great letter, lots of information here, very important to hear. So it's dated March 7th, 2022. So obviously this is still in its fundamental form, but I believe it's complete and it's just waiting for final signatures before we submit it on the 7th. Dear Mr. Wura and Ms. Barnett, the undersigned organizations respectfully request that the Department of the Interior and Department of Agriculture safeguard mature and old growth trees and forests across federal lands. To this end, our organizations are calling on the administration to promulgate a strong and durable rule to protect mature and old growth trees and forests from logging across federal lands administered by the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service as a cornerstone of U.S. climate policy. We also underscore the importance of linking national policy to international climate commitments that emphasize the importance of protecting, conserving, and restoring nature and ecosystems. First, a rulemaking to secure these forest protections would advance the goals of the 30 by 30 initiative and take a profound step toward addressing the most important environmental challenges of our time. Along with identifying areas that are already permanently protected, the Conservation and Stewardship Atlas should include information highlighting the urgent importance of conserving mature and old growth trees and forests from logging and prioritizing the recovery of old growth forests that have been lost on federal lands. As outlined below, protecting these critical forest elements is a low-cost, scientifically proven, rapidly deployable strategy for both climate change mitigation and adaptation.
Older trees and forests make essential contributions to mitigating climate change as natural climate solutions. They store vast amounts of carbon accumulated over decades to centuries and are continuously sequestering additional carbon as they grow and age. The annual rate of carbon sequestration generally increases as trees get older and larger, and older trees in general store a disproportionate amount of a forest above ground carbon. Cutting down older trees and forest stands emits a substantial amount of that carbon back into the atmosphere when storage and wood products is taken into account. Tree planting following logging is not an adequate substitution measure for older forests, as it can take at least a century to make up the carbon lost in logging old trees. In sum, there is no comparison between the carbon value of bigger trees versus much smaller saplings. In the Northeast United States, for example, protected forests that have been allowed to age without human disturbance cover just 5% of the region's land, but store 30% of the total above ground forest carbon. In temperate rainforests of the Pacific Northwest, older forests can have higher biomass carbon density per acre than both boreal and tropical forests. The majority of the most carbon-dense forests in this region are on federal lands and have benefited from reduced logging levels.
Mature and old-growth trees and forests support adaptation to the impacts of climate change that ecosystems and people across the country are already experiencing. For instance, older forests maintain water balance in forested watersheds, which helps reduce the impacts of flooding and drought. They also produce the highest outputs of ecosystem services like clean drinking water and provide climate refugia for diverse fish and wildlife. Many tree species also tend to become naturally more resilient to fire as they mature. They develop thick, fire-resistant bark, maintain high canopies that help maintain a cool, moist understory, and hold their moist, flammable biomass high above the ground and out of reach of surface fires. While land management agencies should adhere to the best available science for mitigating the future risk of wildfire to communities, conserving mature and old growth trees and forests is not in conflict with these objectives. Older forests and trees and biodiversity benefit. Across all forest types and regions, older trees and forests provide vital habitat for many plants and wildlife, particularly imperiled species. For example, the availability of dead, dying, and downed wood, increasingly removed from forests for biofuels, mass timber, and other uses of so-called low-grade wood, is critical for the viability of many species. Insectivorous bats that help to keep insect pests in check, to pine marten, to a wide range of beneficial invertebrates. Many of the nation's most imperiled bird species are adapted to older forests and rely upon complex forest structure for their survival, including snags and large living trees. In general, the biodiversity found in older forests tends to be far higher compared to logged forests across the country.
Forests purify the air we breathe, filter the water we drink, and support the salmon and other wildlife that are intrinsic to our nation's identity. Protecting and recovering mature and old growth forests across federal lands in the United States offers numerous environmental justice co-benefits that are difficult to quantify, but must be considered. Access to nature and outdoor recreation, enhanced public health and cultural practices can all be supported through better forest protections. A strong and enduring rule that secures the protection of older forests and trees on federal public lands for the benefit of this and future generations would advance the goals of the 3030 initiative and take a profound step toward addressing the global climate and biodiversity crisis. We request that you include this information in the Atlas and in response to President Biden's 3030 executive order. And so right now there are several groups that have signed on to this important letter across the country. And I'm just going to share the list because I think it's pretty inspirational that this type of activity is happening. People are united across the country in trying to implement President Biden's rule by trying to get these older forests into the reserve. So the groups currently on the list are 350 Massachusetts, 350 Montana, 350 Seattle, 350 Portland, Appalachians Trail Conservancy, the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, Cascade Forest Conservancy, the Central Oregon Bitter Brush Broads Chapter, Great Broads for Wilderness, Conservation Northwest, Cottonwood Environmental Law Center, Earth Action Incorporated, Earth Justice, Environment America, Environmental Protection Information Center, Forest Keeper, Forest Web, Friends of Big Ivy, Greater Hells Canyon Council, High Country Conservation Advocates, Highlands Nature Sanctuary, iHeart Pisgua, Inland Ocean Coalition, Kentucky Heartwood, Klamath Forest Alliance, Natural Resource Council of Maine, New Jersey Highlands Coalition, Oregon Wild, Rocky Mountain Wild, South Umpqua Rural Community Partnership, Sunrise Portland, the Clinch Coalition, the Fire Restoration Group, Umpqua Watersheds, Washington Wild, Wild Earth Companion, Williams Community Forest Project, and the Yaak Valley Forest Council. Now, I anticipate in the next few days there will be a few more that come on to this letter, but it is so inspirational to me that these groups are working together to make a positive difference and be a force in getting this enacted.
Absolutely. I'm extremely excited and inspired by this. I was particularly excited to see voices from the East Coast, Massachusetts and Maine. And I'm also excited to see Earth Justice, because Earth Justice, in my opinion, you know, it ranks right up there with Sierra Club as having a lot of influence on national issues. You know, their court cases have laid precedent for many, many years. And so it's exciting to me to see not just the nationwide movement, you know, like I said, Massachusetts and New Jersey and Maine, but also to see the big names in there that are supporting this as well and are signing on to the letters that we generate here with the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance. I think we're doing great work here. And as you said, this list that are members that are signing on to the letter, this isn't necessarily exhaustive. There's still time. Other groups and coalitions and nonprofits have time to sign on to this as well. So, Casey, I have a question for you. There's a lot of great information in this letter. And at the end of it are a lot of great citations that would be a great reference for people that still have questions if they wanted to verify the assertions that are made in this letter. Is there a way that we could possibly make this letter or at least the citations or something of this up on our website so that our listeners can verify this information for themselves? Is this something we can do?
Yes. When we put up this podcast for this show, we'll put the letter in the notes. If folks want to look at it, go to the webpage, go to this podcast on kqua.org under Living Downstream, and they can see it there. I think there'll be a lot more groups sign on. I know our friends at the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition weren't on the list, and I know they want to be. So I'll make sure that they have this sign on to the letter before March 7th. Douglas County Global Warming Coalition is actively working on impacting what's happening on rulemaking at our own Oregon legislature. They're focused on getting support for the electric vehicle rebate and are asking for public comment on proposed rules. Speaking of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, I want to highlight event that is going to be happening that they're sharing. It's an Electrify Now event. It's happening via Zoom on March 23rd from 6:30 to 8 p.m. It's about Electrify Now, accelerating the transition to a clean energy future. So we're going to put this up on our website so that you can find out about it. You can also to Douglas County Global Warming Coalition.com to get more information regarding the Electrify Now event on March 23rd. So let's go back and talk a little bit about the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance. Last episode of our climate show, we talked about what the principles are for the Pacific Northwest Climate Alliance. We want to talk a little bit about the working groups, which really drive what's happening in there. And I know we're both involved in several of these groups, and there's really good things that are happening based on the coalition efforts. The first working group I want to talk about is the Forest Carbon and Oregon's Climate Action Plan. The Forest Carbon Executive Order 2004 is a working group that is focusing on how the Oregon Department of Forestry can best implement the directives given from Governor Brown in her executive order on climate action, Oregon Climate Action Plan, and transition to climate smart forest practices. We are advocating for a multi-pronged approach that focuses on pressuring key decision makers, establishing solid messaging points and demands where we can gain broad support and developing tangible policy concepts around increasing long-term carbon stores on the landscape. While the work that we are doing is focused on the implementation of EO 2004 ODF policy, we aim to create replicable messaging and policy that can serve as models for climate smart transitions in other states and nationally.
So there's another working group here of interest with the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, and that's the Wildfire Working Group. Our working groups, the Wildfire Working Group's primary mission is to empower forest and climate activists to successfully counter the anti-fire pro-logging propaganda from the timber industry, as well as the government agencies and their political allies that claim protecting forests makes them vulnerable to wildfires and or logging forests can prevent wildfires. Our secondary mission is to educate people about the many connections between climate change, wildfires, forest protection, and the role of ecological fire management in protecting communities, sustaining forests, and recovering climate stability.
Another group that we're involved in is a rural organizing group. The Rural Organizing Working Group is composed of groups and individuals that do forest and climate-related work in rural communities. The working group is a space to discuss working in rural areas and create messaging and activist toolkit geared towards rural communities. The group is currently focused on hosting a series of virtual gatherings where we can hear about each other's rural organizing challenges and successes, exchange ideas, and help each other strategize for our campaign.
I particularly am interested in work on the Green New Deal for the Pacific Northwest Forests Working Group. The Green New Deal Working Group has spent the past year working hard creating the Green New Deal for Pacific Northwest Forest platform and building support for it. This platform makes clear the role that intact forest ecosystems can play in mitigating the climate crisis while providing millions of good paying jobs and a just transition frontline and historical marginalized communities. Now we aim to use the document that we've created as a positive platform for grassroots organizing, a venue for storytelling about green jobs and climate smart forestry, and a starting point for making both state level and national policy.
So another important working group is the Federal Landscape Working Group. And you can see part of the what's happening because of this working group based on the letter that we just shared with you. This working group is working to get the Biden administration to put significant protections on mature and old growth in the Tongass National Forest and the carbon-rich temperate forest of the Pacific Northwest.
So there's also the Climate and Industrial Forest Working Group. This working group is forming within the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance to unite forest and climate activists to launch a Divest from Wall Street Forestry campaign and champion social benefit solutions to financial forest ownership and management. The linkage between Pacific Northwest forest and climate is profound due to the globally outstanding carbon storage potential of the region's forest. In part, the need to impact the bottom line of Wall Street-owned forest plantations and transition them to carbon-dense, locally owned and managed forests guides this work. So this is an important working group. I would encourage everybody to jump onto this if you're interested in helping with this campaign. It's going to be vital moving forward as we work toward long-term mitigation strategies.
So the final working group we want to highlight is the field surveying group, and it's very near to our hearts because we are extremely active with this group. The field surveying working group is made up of organizations and community members who monitor, visit, and document threatened places in order to advocate for the protection. Members of the working group visit forests slated for logging and use observations found in the field to engage public timber sale processes and sometimes wind protections for special places. The working group is a resource hub, space to share stories from the field and recruit support for on-the-ground timber sale campaigns. Members of the working group are creating a community photo repository project to document destructive logging happening on public lands and are providing trainings and resources to those looking to start field survey programs in their neck of the woods. So as I mentioned, Umpqua Watersheds is very active with this group. Cascadia Wildlands, BARC out of Mount Hood. It's a really important group, and there's so much work that's being done with these groups to go out and do surveying. We've been out in the Archie Creek fire. We've been on BLM land. We've been on Forest Service land, looking at what's happening, cataloging actions, engaging agencies, engaging private industry on trying to tell the story so that hopefully by telling the story, we prevent some actions from happening. Unfortunately, the story doesn't always have a happy ending, and we're going to tell that too and hold people accountable. So the group is presenting at the Public Information and Environmental Law Conference. It's online. Go to PILC.com. We're presenting on Saturday from 10:15 to 11:15. On field surveying. The good thing is it's recorded. So go to PILC.com and you'll be able to view all the presentations and the one being done on field surveying. KQUA LP Roseburg, a community service of Umpqua Watersheds. Umpqua Watersheds is dedicated to the protection and restoration of the ecosystems of the Umpqua Watersheds and beyond through education, training, advocacy, and ecologically sound stewardship.
More information at umpquawatersheds.org and on Facebook.